Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking apart this week's question time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
And frankly, we should not be falling into their traps and aping the sort of paranoia that we've seen in the coverage of this, in the likes, let's say, of the Canary.
What's up, everyone? I am Stefan Topski. It is Sunday the 16th of December, and that can only mean one thing. It's episode 5 of Topple Uncaged. Yes, the Canary was mentioned in Parliament this week. Apparently, we've been spreading paranoid, malicious gossip about something called the Integrity Initiative. No, heavens above, of course not. Of course, that Foreign Office-funded body hasn't been using Twitter to promote anti-Corbyn propaganda. No, nothing to see here. But of course, if you are a fan of the facts, then in the next 20 minutes, I've got loads for you. We'll be looking at some of the week's big stories, I'll be taking down question time, and I will have a fabulous musical guest to tickle you. So, have your Kalashnikov at the ready, comrades, because trust me, the truth is out there. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. Yes, you know what this section is. It is Plucked News, the UK's quickest news roundup, in my opinion. 5 news stories, 5 minutes. Can I do it? Can I fit it all in? Can I give you all the information you need regarding this week's top stories? Let's find out in 3, 2, 1... And we're off. And first up, it's The Guardian, and they reported that long-term plan for NHS funding delayed amid Brexit chaos. This is the story of Theresa May delaying how she is going to spend the £20.5 billion she promised for the NHS back last June. The document relating to how this money is going to be pushed out across the health service is pushed back till January, apparently, because of, quote, Brexit chaos. I don't think it's to do with Brexit chaos. I think it's more the fact that Theresa May is hoping to start the new year on an upbeat note by saying, yes, we're throwing all this money at the health service, when in reality, as health service bosses are already questioning, what are they going to have to do to claw back some savings to allow this £20.5 billion to be even put into the health service in the first place? But of course, it poses the bigger question of the Tories' plans for the NHS. We have seen, since they came to power in 2010, the decimation of services, chronic understaffing, chronic wait times, spending per patient cut in real terms. And it looks like this is just going to continue. Why they're doing this? We all know why they're doing this. It's stealth privatisation of the health service. You can trace it back to the 80s, where Oliver Letwin, a senior Tory, who still advises government, by the way, wrote a paper talking about how to privatise the NHS. Fast forward to 2005, and Jeremy Hunt wrote in the pamphlet about how the NHS should be replaced with an insurance system. The Tories' agenda is one of privatisation by stealth. Run a service so far into the ground that the public left with no option but to accept a private service. We saw it in the 80s and 90s with British Rail. They run the service into the ground, curly sandwiches, cold coffee, and the public thought, oh well, it's going to be far better in private hands. That worked out well, didn't it? And for story number 2, we're across to Reuters, and they reported that Johnson & Johnson knew for decades that asbestos lurked in its baby powder. This is the story of Johnson & Johnson, currently facing thousands of lawsuits from people claiming that its talcum powder has given them cancer. But moreover, Reuters have done this investigation, and they found that Johnson & Johnson were putting asbestos into babies' talcum powder, and kept that information secret from regulators and the public. This is just astounding. Essentially, you were patting your baby's bottom with one of the most deadly chemicals known to man, and no one knew anything about it. But should we be surprised at this? No, of course we shouldn't. You just have to look to another corporate company, Monsanto, and their Roundup Weed Killer, which they had to recently pay out millions of dollars to another man who found that it had caused him cancer. But this corporatist nightmare stretches back decades. Again, Monsanto, remember Agent Orange? If you don't, I'll put a link in the show notes. And it's just part of a bigger problem in society where corporations think they can run roughshod over the public health, public interest, all for the sake of a quick buck and cheap profit. This is an outrageous story, and don't even get me started on the fact that asbestos is still found in this country, in schools, social housing. Check out my social housing. I've got cracked asbestos tiles on my floor. This Johnson & Johnson story is a major scandal, and I think it's going to run and run. This is probably just going to be the tip of the iceberg, and a very dirty one at that. Next up, story number 3, and I'm off to my mate, campaigner and lawyer Peter Stefanovic. And he tweeted on the 15th of December, as RMT union members take their 40th day of strike action today, this is the interview with the RMT president, Sean Hall, mainstream media does not want you to see. This strike is about public safety, hashtag keep the guard on the train. This is a story of more strikes on Northern Rail. This is all about driver-only operated trains, essentially where train companies are removing guards from the trains and replacing them with driver-only operations. While the train companies claim that they'll have safety trained people on board, this is not the point. As RMT quite rightly point out, it puts passenger safety at risk because you do not have a member of staff wandering constantly up and down the trains. Also, there's no consideration from these train companies for disabled passengers. We hear story after story after story of disabled people being left stranded at stations because staff are not there, they're not adequately manned, and miscommunication between the train company and the platform staff. In fact, my friends at ABC Commuters and DPAC claim that this may well breach the Equality Act 2010. Meanwhile, the governments are quite happy to let this happen because, as we repeatedly see with the rail industry in this country, they have a complete hands-off approach to it. Just look to the East Coast Main Line, previously a nationalised service, which was the best performing one in the country, then handed over to Richard Branson and Stagecoach, went completely down the pan, and those two companies bowed at the last minute because they weren't making enough money and it cost the taxpayer £2 billion. All power to the RMT, they need to keep doing this because this is a safety critical issue for passengers, and moreover, it is detrimental to disabled people. Keep striking, guys. Moving on, and we're across to the fantastic website Drill or Drop, and they reported that red level tremor stops fracking as total seismic events top 50. This story is unbelievable. This is Quadrilla at Preston New Road, who have now had more than 50 earthquakes at their site since they started drilling again in mid-October. 50 earthquakes, the strongest of those was 1.5 magnitude, and every time Quadrilla has a seismic event above 0.5 magnitude, it has to stop fracking for 18 hours. Now, Quadrilla keeps spinning that this is fine, nothing to see here, nothing wrong, it's perfectly normal, as do the government. This is not perfectly normal. Researchers from Stanford University said that these small tremors will invariably lead to larger ones. Look to Peter Stiles as well in the UK, a professor of geophysics who used to advise the government. He is also warning that these could lead to larger events. As I've previously said on this podcast, fracking is hyper-corporatist capitalism. It's where the lines between government and big business become so blurred you can't see the arse for its head. 50 earthquakes around a fracking site, even if they are small magnitudes, is not acceptable. And finally, for story number 5, I'm back home to the Canary, and my mate Tracy Keeling, who reported that after a chaotic week, Theresa May's now so rattled she's even attacking the Daily Mail. I have to say I laughed a bit when I read this story. So Theresa May was at a press conference in Brussels. A Daily Mail journalist started questioning her and she retorted back, "Oh, you shouldn't believe everything you read in the newspapers," a direct insult to the Daily Mail, which has only been supporting her this week, telling people to lay off and vote for her plan. Has Theresa May lost the plot? Is it because Paul Dacre is no longer heading up the Daily Mail that she's now turning on them? To be honest, I think it's more that Theresa May and some Tory MPs are acting like absolute rats in a sack at the minute. The EU deal is falling apart around them. The Tory party is imploding, eating itself like a bunch of zombies. But there's some mirth to be had in Theresa May turning on the Daily Mail, I have to say. It is just hilarious. One of the most noxious prime ministers we've ever had in history versus one of the most noxious newspapers ever created, and now they're eating each other alive. But to be honest, that quite neatly sums up the Tory party this week, and if we don't have a no-confidence vote from Corbyn soon, I think the government may well fall anyway. Not least because of the rate they're ripping the meat off each other's bones, there won't be anything left of them. And having had time to talk about my mate Seema Chandwani, who's launched the Tottenham Youth Fund, and she's donating £1,000 a year of her councillor salary to that very fund. Seema, this is fantastic. Never mind the fact that the Tories have cut youth service spending left, right and centre, which could be in part leading to the rise in violent crime across the capital, but it's great to see councillors like Seema doing something like this. Seema, all power to you. Love you lots. Brilliant work. Nor have I time to mention the beast from Bolsover, Dennis Skinner, calling SNP MP Stuart MacDonald a piece of SHIT this week in Parliament. Stuart MacDonald was outraged. SNP got their knickers in a right knot over Dennis Skinner swearing and calling him a piece of SHIT. Check your tweets, Stuart MacDonald, because in 2013 you tweeted, "Why are people so upset at an MP calling someone a little SHIT? I mean, really, don't say you've never." And I haven't even got time to talk about my good mate Benny James, social media personality and influencer, who started a campaign around men's mental health. It's involving the hashtag I'm Still A Man, and he wants men to speak up about their mental health issues, don't be ashamed of it, talk openly about it on Twitter, talk to your mates, get together, try and have fun with it, but also raise awareness. Benny is a legend. He's a social media personality, but also quite often all over the papers. All power to you, Benny. Big up, my friend. And I haven't even had time to go in on the BBC, who were teleporting children this week in their live news. No, really. There was big hoo-ha about coverage on the BBC of a woman who was speaking up for Theresa May, and suddenly this child appeared from nowhere in the footage. Essentially what happened, the BBC did some dodgy editing. People claimed that it was to make this woman look like she was supporting Theresa May more than she was, and this child suddenly appeared from nowhere in the footage. It was absolutely staggering, the BBC said. The effect was caused from a loose frame accidentally left at the end of the edit after the contributor had finished speaking. We didn't mean to spook anyone. You haven't spooked anyone, BBC. We know exactly where your bias lies, and it's with the establishment. And I'd like to say I've got time for a lie down and 20 fags after that, but I'm not, because we're straight into this. Dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, free-flying with... Right, I would have to have a completely separate podcast to reel off all the accomplishments and talents of my next guest. He is a campaigner, he is a writer, he's a journalist, he runs a food bank, and now he's also a playwright. It is the fabulous, wonderful, my very good friend Ray Wolford. Ray, thank you so much for joining me on Topalong Cage today.
It's always a delight and a privilege, mate.
It's
privilege.
Really, really, really lovely to speak to you. We haven't spoken in a while, and it's great to have you on here. So, as usual, with Free Flying With, we have three stories to get through. One is chosen by Twitter, one is your choice, and one is my choice. So we're going to start off with what Twitter decided via a poll, and it was the situation with rising UK poverty. Essentially, the most up-to-date information on this is that the Joseph Rowntree Foundation reported last week that there are now 4 million British workers in poverty, 4.1 million children in poverty, and the figure for the number of children in working households where one parent works hasn't really shifted. That's around 67% of the 4.1 million children. Ray, the situation with poverty just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. It's a plague almost on society. But I want to sort of throw something at you. It's a bit left field. Is this really all the Tories' fault, or do we have a systems problem with poverty in this country and across the globe?
I think the problem is the Tories are really just puppets. If you look around the world, there's all these different political organisations which front the various governments that we have. Poverty is something which actually makes so many people terribly rich, whether it's the utility companies which get poor people to pay up front, who pay a premium for that, organizations like Bright House that charge, you know, excessive amounts of money on high interest washing machines that people can't afford to pay up front, to big organizations that pay very little tax in the UK, who pay their workers crap money because they know at the end of the day the taxpayer, you and I, will subsidize their low pay, which is really a tax break to big business shareholders. And it's a scam that needs to stop. Poverty, too many people are making money out of it. And the Joseph Rowntree made a really interesting figure, analysts of it, that it actually costs £78 billion a year. That's when you add in the cost of things like impact on the health service. So you may think, oh yeah, poverty doesn't affect me, but of course it does. The health service is terribly stretched at the moment. And part of the problem is people in poverty eat very poor food, because to buy a loaf of bread is 47p, but to buy a healthy Swede or tomatoes is like £2. What are you going to feed your kids? And that, of course, has a negative impact, not just on people's health, but also on their educational opportunities, their mental health and their well-being. And if people have poor health, we all have to pay for it in stresses on the NHS.
The only solution that presents itself really at the moment is the possibility of a Labour government. Now, I'm not convinced that Labour is quite right on this. I don't think they're going to go far enough, because as we've just discussed, we have a systemic problem with poverty. It is essentially capitalism which is to blame. And unless I've missed it, I don't think John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn are calling for an end to capitalism. So if Labour is the best we've got, is it going to be enough to solve this crisis that we see in this country?
Well, I mean, one of the good things about Corbyn is the fact that he's brought into the Labour movement a whole generation of new people who really understand the causes of poverty and will actually change it. And what we're all impatient for is obviously the Labour government that will actually deliver on it. The reality is that to date, my motion that has been touring Labour constituency, Labour parties, and was passed at Blackpool Conference, calling for the next Labour government to appoint a minister to eradicate and make poverty history, has not become Labour policy. And with 12 million people in poverty, you would think that's a strong enough voter base for the Labour Party to say, look, this is a key issue. We are serious about tackling social inequality and poverty as the stain on our society that it is, and actually say, no ifs, no buts, a ministry is what we're going to appoint. Not just to do it as tokenism, but actually see how poverty impacts on the health service, on education, on work, employment, training opportunities, housing, etc. Yeah. If we could do that, I would be first in the queue knocking doors to get Corbyn into number 10.
My sort of overarching concern is that we have a systems problem in terms of the fact that it's capitalism, and it is poverty is essentially built into capitalism, where you have a system where only a very small percentage of the population benefit from it really. Then of course it's going to lead to this constant inequality we see. But I mean, there's always been poor people over the 6,000 years of civilizations. So unless we're talking a complete species reboot, it concerns me that
I'm not sure anything's going to solve it. But that kind of segues us quite nicely into our next topic, actually, because we're going to talk about another massive issue, which I don't think maybe either of us are convinced that politicians are going to solve, and that is, of course, climate change. Now, Greta Thunberg, the 15-year-old Swedish girl who has been doing her school strike over climate change, absolutely fantastic young lady. She made a brilliant speech this week. Briefly, I'll quote from her. She said, "The year 2078, I will celebrate my 75th birthday. If I have children, maybe they will spend that day with me. Maybe they will ask me about you." She was talking to political leaders. "Maybe they will ask why you didn't do anything while there was still time to act. You say you love your children above all else, yet you are stealing their future in front of their very eyes. Do you think there is the political will to do something about climate change before it's too late?"
Well, I just think it's really great that we've actually got young people which are leading this campaign and raising awareness. But the reality is that in the politics we live, which is very short term, is that it takes years to become one of those five issues that people campaign about. You and I, you're only too aware as housing activists, it's only the past 4 years that housing has justly become one of the most important political issues and one in which all political parties have started to act on, even though they have not acted to the level we would like. At least they're moving on it. The reality with climate change, until people go to their kitchen sink and turn on the tap and no water comes out of it, we are not going to see change. I mean, I'm a huge campaigner. And the reality is that people see it as other people's problems. When you're in the comfort of your own home, you can watch the lovely Attenborough programs. You can watch all these different TV and magazines, and you see these wonderful animals in the wilderness. And the reality is that's somewhere else. It's almost a dream sequence. It's not our problem. It's for another day. We're all busy struggling to get through each day. And climate is just something that we think somebody else would deal with. Somebody else can take it on.
Absolutely.
We're busy surviving.
But the problem is, if politicians don't have the will, do you think, therefore, we need to be looking to movements like Extinction Rebellion to actually try and force this issue? Because they're looking for, ultimately, a systems change as well. On the face of it, they're protesting about climate change, but what is underpinning their movement, having spoken to them at length, is the fact that they want a whole democratic change to the way we run our countries and our societies. So do you think this kind of campaigning and activism is the next big way to go on this?
I think the next big climate issue is actually going to be about water and land ownership. If you look actually around the world, that's happening in Africa, all the land in Africa at the moment is being bought up in huge acres and an epic scale by the Chinese. If you look at water supplies around the world, private companies are buying up water on an epic scale. And, you know, we had the case not so long ago in South America where we had a whole country was brought almost to the streets because of the privatization of the water and the fact the poorest people were being charged so much money that they couldn't eat. They needed the money that they had to buy water. So I think that the next climate thing, I mean, yes, of course, we care about animals, we care about things, but the biggest climate is food, where our food is going to become on with an increasing growing population. But I think that in a practical level, the issue that is simple for people to get through a soundbite is lack of pure water and access to free water. And I think what we need to do with all our campaigning and all our politicization is keeping the issue simple, like fracking. Fracking was a really good example, something people could simply understand and get behind and mobilize. So I think it's not the wider issue of the animals and the climate, but actually water that will be the issue that becomes the big campaign in the next 10 years.
That's a very interesting point, actually. You've given me food for thought though. I haven't considered it in those terms before. Of course, also, just to throw one last thing into the mix before we move on, we have the issue of the fact that we're seeing the effects of climate change already. I mean, it's highly underreported, especially in the Western press. But of course, what's happening in Syria was all sparked by the biggest drought in nearly 900 years, back at the time of the Arab Spring. I think there's another issue that we're going to have to look at, is the fact that we're going to see more mass migration, more refugees. And in the meantime, of course, then in the Middle East, to juxtapose with that, companies and governments are not going to stop drilling for oil, because, I mean, if you look at Saudi Arabia, they're nearly 50% of their GDP is based on oil, and Saudi Arabia is a key ally of ours, so we're not going to want to upset them. There's sort of loads of crossroads in this, if you like, and again, that fits in with the next topic we're going to talk about, because you're not having a great time on Twitter at the minute, and I completely understand why. The long and the short of it is, you run a food bank, and your food bank this year is struggling with donations to basically keep itself going. But you've made, if you read Ray's Twitter feed, you made some very interesting points about about sort of activism and the attitude of the left and what the left is actually doing when it comes to campaigning. You've made some excellent points, but let's start. What's the situation with your food bank? Tell me about that. What's going on there?
Well, the problem is this is the first time in 5 years that we've actually run out of money. I mean, we have an income of about £50. If it wasn't for my book, Food Bank Britain, we would probably not be able to feed anyone. Mm. And this Christmas, we have a double whammy. We have Universal Credit, which is going to hit our area hard in January.
You're Lewisham, aren't you?
We're Lewisham, yeah. And so we're going to end up with a situation where many of the people that normally donate to us don't have the money to donate because they're worried about how they're going to get through Christmas. And the stores that used to donate now give to the big corporations. A lot of people don't realize that a lot of the food stores that collect food quite often is then sold on. Many of the organizations collect the food and they sell it on, although it's a cheaper price. We food banks have to buy that food that is donated for free. And we pay VAT on it because it's regarded as a service. So not only do we have to buy the food that people donate at the supermarkets, we have to pay 20% VAT on top of it. And so if people are too poor to give you cash and people don't have the money to give you food, then there is a limit to what you can do. And so I put on a festival, the Deptford Heritage Festival, which gives us the money to run a school holiday project, which is run by parents and teachers who do it for love. But of course, the insurance costs us a fortune. We have to buy food and we have to hire the halls because now we have no community centres. We have to pay rent, which is £600 a week. So I do my Play Liberty, which again will fund a school holiday project. And I think one of the problems with the left is that people now with Twitter think that to be an activist now, all they need to do is tweet. And to a certain extent, that is true. There's a lot of people that follow me who have disability issues, who are housebound, and I really value their engagement. And the fact they're engaged with me is great. My point is that lots of that, those of us that do are getting smaller and smaller, whether it's people's excuse that they're trying to get through day to day. Too many of us on the left seem to forget that what we need to be doing, we need to be showing more solidarity. It's not about money with each other. It's like when we know somebody's down, sending them a little tweet of solidarity saying, look, you know, I know you're having a tough time. I support you, like what you've done with me this week. I've had a terrible time this week. On top of everything else, my partner, my husband's been diagnosed with cancer. So, I'm having a real terrible time. I am seeing the misery around me living in London, and I'm worried sick that this Christmas, not only can I not give people, you know, their meat and their vegetables and their fruit that I always give them for Christmas, but even to give somebody a loo roll this week, this year, is going to be a luxury that I will have no money and no donations to give. And that is actually heartbreaking to know that, you know, our food bank was closed. We had our own shop that produced an income. But because of gentrification, our rent went from 7,500 to 32,000. Because we didn't have a cash income, we couldn't get a charity number. So our council wanted 18,000 in business rates. So we had to close. So now we run our food bank from people's kitchens and people's front rooms, door to door. We're like that, you know, the old fashioned Christmas clubs that went from door to door on the council estates on the 60s. That's how we're running our food club now. I don't know if I'm going to be able to give anybody even a tin of beans or even a bowl of rice.
It's extremely concerning, and I think what you've just described and what's happening in Deptford and happening in Lewisham and what's happening to you and what you said on Twitter is kind of it's a microcosm of what is going on across the country. Because, I mean, I'm going to put my hands up here and be honest. Me and Nicola had this conversation just the other day about that I've been sitting here thinking that while it's lovely that I do the podcast and I get issues out there and I write a lot and I get issues out there via my writing and I do bits of telly here and there, and I always make sure I push the narratives I want to push and raise awareness of issues I want to raise. I don't do half the activism that I used to do. and I'm going to hold my hands up that I'm guilty of that and I need to do more. And this one, my first thing, conscious decision for 2019 is, nope, I'm going to need to do more activism because I don't do enough. And I think there's a lot of us that are probably guilty of that. And it's like, but we need to be doing activism more than ever, because the thing is, you have, I'm going to say it as well, you have movements like People's Assembly, which are all lovely and very nice, great. they don't bloody achieve anything. I'm sorry. These A to B marches are done. There are no more of these because nothing ever changes. And essentially what they've turned into is little cash cows for people to earn a salary off, and they pay Westminster Council and Westminster Police tens of thousands of pounds to do these marches, which never change anything. And we have to, as a left, really look in on ourselves, I think, and look at what we are doing and change the way we are operating, because things are getting worse, and it concerns me that we are essentially losing our way somewhat. If you're listening to this, I think you should have a look at what Ray said on Twitter, because it is very, very on point, and it will give you food for thought. And I think as this year draws to a close, we could all do with some maybe self-reflection. I know I could. And I think he has a lot of important points which need to be raised. So, Ray, I, as always, appreciate your candidness. But I really appreciate as well you coming on my podcast today, because it was a last-minute affair. So I thank you so much for your time. And it's lovely to speak to you, and we will have to physically meet up very soon.
Definitely. And I just want to say, Steve, that I'm not ashamed of being on a march with you for the homeless. So when you say you don't do enough, you've done a lot more than some of the Owen Jones and the other types that claim to be journalists and reporters. So working and writing is really important. And I just want to say a quick point. But if it wasn't for writing, I mean, you know, some of you may be aware that I had a friend of mine, Hisham Alamishi, who was captured by the Houthis and kept in a jail in Yemen. And if it wasn't for my Twitter followers and my social media presence and negotiations through Twitter with the Houthis in Yemen, we would never have got him out. And that's something we achieved through our writing, you and me, and through our activism and our Twitter. So I don't want anybody to think that writing undermines our activism.
I know. Ray, thank you so much for coming on, and you're coming back in the new year whether you like it or not to discuss your play, because it's absolutely wonderful. But for the minute, Ray, thank you so much for joining me, and if I don't speak to you before, have a peaceful Christmas as possible, please, and a peaceful new year as well. Ray Wolford, thank you. Taking down this week's BBC QT, it's question time. Tobble chirps back. Question time never ceases to amaze me, none more so than this week. Did anyone else spot the error? Oh, sorry, not an error. It was perfectly intentional by BBC Question Time. Having two Tories on the panel, both Nicky Morgan and David Davis. But sorry, their Brexit position is different, obviously. And we're back to that again. Brexit, Brexit, Brexit. I think, like you, I'll probably be glad when this is all over. Anyway, so what has Question Time got for me this week? First question, please.
Would you consider a second and better informed referendum the best democratic way forward?
No, I don't believe it is the best democratic way forward. Look, the fact of the matter is, we had a referendum in 2016 on this. Now, whether some people like it or not, we democratically voted to leave the European Union. In my opinion, the issue has not been the result of that vote. It's not been that we voted incorrectly, because I do believe we should leave the EU, and I think in 20 years' time, we will look back and be glad we did. The issue has been the people managing the exit process, the Conservative Party. Because of the fact they are so divided themselves internally over the EU, there could never have been a good solution to this. We were always stuck between a rock and a hard place. So therefore, it's been the Tories' mismanagement of this whole process that has been the issue. So no, I don't think we should have a second referendum. I don't think we should have a people's vote. If anything, we should, as Labour are calling for, have a general election to decide whether the country wants to continue with the Tories' complete shambolic Brexit as it stands, or they want to get Labour in to clean up their mess. Next question, please.
What would it actually take for Corbyn to vote for May's deal?
Have you not just listened to my previous answer? Corbyn should not, of course, vote for May's deal. May's deal is a complete catastrophe, not least for Ireland, not least for Northern Ireland, but it pleases no one. It doesn't please any leavers, it doesn't please the Remainers, it pleases hardly anyone in her party. I mean, when she's got the Daily Mail coming out and supporting her, you know something's wrong. Of course Corbyn shouldn't vote for this deal. He's supposed to be Her Majesty's opposition, which means to oppose. And quite frankly, what he is suggesting is a far better plan than hers. And final question, please.
Is it realistic to expect comedians to sign behavioural contracts, or should comedy be free from censorship?
Okay, so this is a row over a comedian having to sign a contract at a university saying they would not say certain things. Look, it's a very fine line with comedy, isn't it? I think as long as the boundaries do not get pushed into anything abusive, anything inciting hate, then anything should be fair game. Satire is one of the cleverest forms of wit, and it's crucial in this country that we have clever, especially political satire, taking apart what the establishment are doing. To be honest, though, we pale in comparison to the US if you look at the likes of Lee Camp, who I was very proud to have on this podcast several weeks ago. He is an absolutely cutting-edge comedian, and his satire is second to none. So no, I don't think people should be censored, and quite frankly, the PC Brigade has gone far too far in this country. And that's it. Maybe with Fiona Bruce coming on board next year, we can expect a bit better quality of Question Time, or will it still be all about Brexit? Jury's out for me. But until next week, thank you, Question Time. Goodbye. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. I say it every week, and you probably get bored of me saying it, but I'm always excited by the people I have on this show. No one more so than this week's guest, which is a brilliant DJ and poet and publisher and all-round really nice guy. It's only Gav Paws, who runs Paws Radio. Gav, thank you so much for coming on at the last minute.
It's a pleasure, mate, and I love being here, you know. I love your works and everything you do, so it's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much. You do an amazing radio show on the internet, and you've recently had a 12-year anniversary. It's been 12 years of you producing a radio show, but this radio show is very special for me. It's a roots reggae inspired show, and I love it. The mainstream media have an issue with roots reggae. Now, I think it's because it's too anti-establishment and too risque for them. However, you are constantly promoting these fantastic artists. How did the show come about 12 years ago?
Well, I was a jungle vinyl DJ playing in clubs at the time, since the mid-90s. And what happened is I was also a keen BMX rider, and I had an accident and fell off the BMX, landed on my head, had to learn reading, writing, walking and talking again to some level. And the roots reggae I found as a great healing tool for myself. I was offered a radio show where I used to live in Nottingham on Unique FM, and they said, oh, we want to offer you a radio show. You know, at the time I was playing a bit of dancehall, but into the roots as well, and I decided to go down the roots side of it, and the popularity has just grown from there, and the progression has grown from there.
Just for listeners who don't know, because I'm not going to make the assumption everyone does, roots reggae, it's a conscious form of music, isn't it? It comes out of talking about political and social issues within Jamaica. That's where it kind of started, but it's broadened out really to talking about global issues, and it's rooted in Rastafari religion, isn't it, as well?
Yeah. And the thing is, it's very diverse. This is the whole thing about the roots, and like you're saying, it originated in Jamaica when the BBC took over some recording equipment, left it there when they had to vacate because of certain reasons. There was just a lot of people there left with the recording devices, and they thought, what shall we do? And they started recording songs to uplift, motivate, and also get across political messages. Yeah. And the way that it's grown throughout the world, it just shows that everybody needs healing, everybody needs uplifting. You know, everybody needs that motivation, the strength to move forward. And that just shows the power in the music itself and the way it's spread.
What you also do, along with roots reggae, you're a damn good poet as well. You have this fantastic book out, and there's this brilliant book of poetry, Pause for Thought, which is accompanied by some amazing photography, sort of street art, and really sort of somewhat intense kind of cityscapes as well. How did the poetry come about? Because it complements the reggae so well.
I was helping someone through a difficult situation, and I just put some words down on a bit of paper, sent them those words, and they came back to me. I'm going, wow, this is amazing. And I was still at a very basic learning stage of learning my reading and writing again.
Yeah.
So it was very simple. What I wrote was very simple. And then because of their reaction, I then shared online some of the poetry that I was writing, and more people came to it and were like, wow, this is amazing. And it inspired me to progress that. And as I progressed it, it was basically a healing tool for myself that was born from helping somebody else. And it's progressed from there. And then obviously with it being posted online, more people seeing it, it started attracting publishers. I had a selection of companies that wanted to produce the book. And I chose a local company because they came with a really good deal for me. And, well, look at the final products they've created with me. When they've created it with me. It wasn't something like where I gave them some words and then they went off and and just put whatever they wanted to it. We had long conversations and long interactions of what pictures were going to go with the book and with which poems and stuff like that. It was very consciously thought out and, again, inspired from reggae because, you know, everything I've been doing over the past 12 years has been heavily influenced by Roots.
It does show in the book. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. And me and Nicola took great pleasure in reading a lot of it. So thank you. Like I say, I think it's been a great year for Roots in 2018. What's been your highlight? Come on, if you had to lay your cards on the table, because you know what mine is, because we discussed this off air. My highlight was Quebec Pyramid Contraband. Just a staggering, mind-blowing album. And as I said to you off air, and I've said it countless times, I will be on my deathbed. And when I look back at the albums that have changed my life and impacted me, not least politically, socially, spiritually, emotionally, Contraband by Quebec Pyramid will be one of those albums. What for you has been the musical highlight of the Roots movement this year?
It's really, really hard to make a choice because there's so much great music out there. But one of the biggest highlights, as well as what you're saying, because I agree with what you're saying, with Kabaka, because he's so talented, and teaming up with Damian Marley, incredible. But I really like Micah Shamaya, Roots Eye Vision. Okay. I think that album blew my mind, like absolutely blew my mind. And I'm a big vinyl collector as well, and that was released on a small run of vinyl, limited edition press of vinyl. So that made it even more special because it's a collector's item. Okay. So that combination of the two, the songs on there, amazingly produced, every song on there I was feeling it really touched my heart, and it's that real rootsy feel to it, so that has to be one of my favorite and probably the best albums of 2018 for myself.
There we go, two top tips from two Roots lovers. I think you've just kind of summed up quite nicely really what Roots is about, because it does touch your heart, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the other thing that with Roots as well, it when I'm listening to a good song, you know, when I know there's a good song, it makes my hair stand on end, like not just on my arms, but all over. You know what I mean? It really, like you say there, and it touches your heart and soul, and good Roots music will resonate with you, you know, and there's people that aren't really into Roots that like Roots, you know, because they've heard one song that really they can feel, you know, they understand it, you know, they get it, you know, and this is the power of the music. I think that's an amazing thing for one genre to be able to reach and touch somebody's heart and soul, you know?
Absolutely. And of course, my other reason for liking it is it's very anti-establishment, so that, which is always good for me. Gav, thank you so much for joining me today. One last thing from you, please. Your top song of this year, which we are going to play a bit of for the listeners at home. What is your top song of this year?
That's really hard, but...
Oh, come on.
It's really, really hard because I can say so many, but I would have to say someone that doesn't get enough airtime is an artist from America called King Mass. And the song is Chase Vampire, and it's on the Officer Rhythm.
Gav, thank you so much for coming on. I really, really appreciate it. And here is King Mass, Chase Vampire.
Some me say Chase Vampire, I are Chase Vampire. The Obia man a come and a dopey conqueror. Me say Chase Vampire, I are Chase Vampire. The beast them a gone with ritual murder. Now the streets in a crisis, blood sacrifices, spilled on the concrete floor. To all them a murder people out the road, I wonder if them ever think about them skull getting born. For every action there is a reaction. At that you feel no. So tell me what you gonna do when we run upon you. Dirty vampire, I warn you. Cause you are run down the youths and a fire shot. But now the youths them struck up and them a fire back. Hey, I and I a blaze the fire hot. Man a chase vampire and bat where vampire bat. The beast a roam and a fire shot. But now the youths them struck up and them a fire back. Hey, the warriors them dip and attack. Man a chase vampire and shell where vampire bat. After me show you know what a guan pan the corner. The beast still a treat we like lamb to slaughter. Commit the act, now them a face the karma. Them create the plot, now them a face the drama. Silver bullet in the revolver. Rise the problem solver, them skin all a dissolve, yeah. Birth of a nation like Anna Turner. Ancestors arise, now the flesh a figure turn. Run down the youths and a fire shot. But now the youths them strap up and them a fire back. Hey, I and I a busy fire hot.
And that's it, episode 5 of Top Line Cage done. I would like to thank my fabulous guests this week, the amazing, the lovely Ray Woolford. Follow him on Twitter, it's at Ray Woolford. The fabulous Gav Paws. Follow him on Twitter, it's at Paws Radio. Also, as always, backstage, thank you to the gorgeous, the wonderful Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter, it's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. And thank you to my in-house singer, it's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter, it's at Ray underscore star 113. Last but not least, thank you to the Canary for uncaging me. Don't forget, join us, become a member. More details at www.thecanary.co. Otherwise, that's it. I will see you next week.
Uncaged.